worked the pry bar under the can's lid, twisted, and popped his free hand down on the end. The lid flew off, and the captain was splashed by some flying solvent. Shit! It did smell bad.
I warned you, comrade captain.
What is this garbage?
It's used to clean mildew off bathroom tiles. It will come right out of the uniform, comrade captain. But be sure you have it dry cleaned soon. An acid solution, you see, it could damage the wool.
The captain wanted to be mad, but the man had warned him, hadn't he? Next time I'll know better, he thought. Very well, take it in.
Thank you. I am sorry about the uniform. Don't forget to have it cleaned.
The captain waved to a private and walked off. The soldier unlocked the door. The driver and his assistant went inside to get a two-wheeled hand truck.
I warned him, the driver said to the private.
You certainly did, comrade.
The soldier was amused. He, too, was looking forward to going off duty. And it wasn't often that you saw an officer get caught. The driver watched his assistant load the cans onto the hand truck and followed him as he wheeled it into the building to the service elevator. Then both returned for the second load. They took the elevator to the third floor, shut the power off, and moved their loads to a storage room directly below the large fourth-floor conference room.
That was good with the captain, the assistant said. Now let's get to work.
Yes, comrade colonel, the driver answered at once.
The four cans of carpet cleaning fluid had false tops, which the lieutenant removed and set aside. Next, he took out the satchel charges. The colonel had memorized the blueprints of the building. The wall pillars were in the outside corners of the room. One charge went to each, fixed to the inboard side. The empty cans were placed next to the charges, hiding them. Next, the lieutenant removed two of the false ceiling panels, exposing the steel beams supporting the fourth-floor slab. The remaining charges were attached there, and the ceiling panels replaced. The charges already had their detonators attached. The colonel took the electronic triggering device out of his pocket. He checked his watch and waited for 3 minutes before pressing the button to activate the timers. The bombs would explode in exactly 8 hours. The colonel watched the lieutenant tidy up, then wheeled the hand truck back to the elevator. 2 minutes later, they left the building. The captain was back.
"Comrade," he said to the driver, "you shouldn't let this old one do all the heavy work. Show some respect."
"You are kind, comrade captain."
The colonel smiled crookedly and pulled a half-liter bottle of vodka from his pocket.
"Drink?"
The captain's solicitous attitude ended abruptly. A worker drinking on duty? In the Kremlin? "Move along."
"Good day, comrade."
The driver got into the truck and drove off. They had to pass through the same security checkpoints, but their papers were still in order. After leaving the Kremlin, the truck turned north on Marksa Prospect and followed it all the way to the KGB headquarters building at 2 Dzerzhinsky Square. Crofton, Maryland.
"Where are the kids?"
"Asleep."
Martha Toland hugged her husband. She was wearing something filmy and attractive.
"I had them out swimming all day, and they just couldn't stay awake."
An impish smile. He remembered the first such smile, on Sunset Beach, Oahu, she with a surfboard and a skimpy swimsuit. She still loved the water. And the bikini still fit.
"Why do I sense a plan here?"
"Probably because you're a nasty, suspicious spook."
Marty walked into the kitchen and came out with a bottle of Lancer's Rosé and 2 chilled glasses.
"Now, why don't you take a nice hot shower and unwind a bit? When you're finished, we can relax."
It sounded awfully good. What followed was even better. Chapter 10. Remember, Remember. Crofton, Maryland. Toland woke to hear his phone ringing in the dark.
He was still dopey from the drive up from Norfolk and the wine. It took a ring or two for him to react properly. His first considered action was to check the display on the clock radio. 2:11. 2 in the fucking morning, he thought, sure that the ringing was caused by a prank or a wrong number. He lifted the receiver.
"Hello," he said gruffly. "Lieutenant Commander Toland, please."
"Uh-oh."
"Speaking."
"This is the Sinklant Intel Watch Officer," the disembodied voice said. "You are ordered to return to your duty station at once. Please acknowledge the order, Commander."
"Back to Norfolk right away. Understood."
Wholly on instinct, Bob rotated himself in the bed to a sitting position, his bare feet on the floor.
"Very well, Commander."
The phone clicked off.
"What is it, honey?" Marty asked. "They need me back at Norfolk."
"When?"
"Now."
That woke her up. Martha Toland bolted upright in the bed. The covers spilled off her chest, and the moonlight through the window gave her skin a pale, ethereal glow.
"But you just got here."
"Don't I know it?"
Bob stood and walked awkwardly toward the bathroom. He had to shower and drink some coffee if he had any hope of reaching Norfolk alive. When he returned 10 minutes later, lathering his face, he saw that his wife had clicked on the bedroom TV to cable network news.
"Bob, you better listen to this."
"This is Rich Sudler coming to you live from the Kremlin," said a reporter in a blue blazer. Behind him, Toland could see the grim stone walls of the ancient citadel fortified by Ivan the Terrible, now being patrolled by armed soldiers in combat dress. Toland stopped what he was doing and walked toward the TV. Something very strange was going on. A full company of armed troops in the Kremlin could mean many things, all of them bad.
"There has been an explosion in the Council of Ministers building here in Moscow. At approximately 9:30 this morning, Moscow time, while I was taping a report not half a mile away, we were surprised to hear a sharp sound coming from the new glass and steel structure, and..."
"Rich, this is Diana McGee at the anchor desk."
The image of Sudler and the Kremlin retreated to a corner of the screen as the director inserted the attractive black anchor person who ran the night desk for CNN.
"I presume that you had some Soviet security personnel with you at the time. How did they react?"
"Well, Diana, we can show you that if you can hold a minute for my technicians to set up that tape. I..."
He pressed the earphone tight into his ear.
"Okay, coming up now, Diana."
The tape cut off the live picture, filling the entire screen.
It was on a pause setting, with Sudler frozen in the middle of a gesture to something or other, probably the part of the wall where they buried important communists, Toland thought. The tape began to roll. Simultaneously, Sudler flinched and spun around as a thundering report echoed across the expanse of the square. By professional instinct, the cameraman turned at once to the source of the sound, and after a moment's wobble, the lens settled in on a ball of dust and smoke expanding up and away from the strangely modern building in the Kremlin's otherwise Slavic Rococo complex. A second later, the zoom lens darted in on the scene. Fully 3 floors of the building had been stripped of their glass curtain wall, and the camera followed a large conference table as it fell down off 1 floor slab that seemed to be dangling from a half-dozen reinforcing rods. The camera went down to street level, where there was one obvious body, and perhaps another, along with a collection of automobiles crushed by debris. In seconds the whole square was filled with running men in uniform and the first of many official cars. A blurred figure that could only be a man in uniform suddenly blocked the camera lens. The tape stopped at that point, and Rich Sudler came back into the screen with a live caption in the lower left corner. Now, at that point, the militia captain who had been escorting us—the militia is the Soviet equivalent of, oh, like a U.S. state police force—he made us stop taping and confiscated our tape cassette. We weren't allowed to tape the fire trucks or the several hundred armed troops who arrived and are now guarding the whole area. But the tape was just returned to us,
and we are able to give you this live picture of the building, now that the fires have been put out. In fairness, I really can't say that I blame him. Things were pretty wild there for a few minutes.
Were you threatened in any way, Rich? I mean, did they act as though they thought you...
Sudler's head shook emphatically.
Not at all, Diana. In fact, more than anything, they seemed concerned for our safety. In addition to the militia captain, we have a squad of Red Army infantrymen with us now, and their officer was very careful to say that he was here to protect us, not to threaten us. We were not allowed to approach the site of the incident, and, of course, we were not allowed to leave the area. But we wouldn't have anyway. The tape was just returned to us a few minutes ago, and we were informed that we'd be allowed to make this live broadcast.
The camera shifted to the building.
As you can see, there are roughly 500 fire, police, and military personnel still here, sorting through the wreckage and looking for additional bodies. And, just to our right, is a Soviet TV news crew, doing the same thing we are.
Toland examined the television picture closely. The one body he could see looked awfully small. He wrote it off to distance and perspective.
Diana, what we seem to have here is the first major terrorist incident in the history of the Soviet Union.
Since the bastards set themselves up, Toland snorted.
We know for certain, at least we've been told, that a bomb was detonated in the Council of Ministers building. They're certain it was a bomb, not some kind of accident. And we know for sure that 3, possibly more people were killed, and perhaps as many as 40 or 50 wounded. Now, the really interesting thing about this is that the Politburo had been scheduled to hold a meeting here at about that time.
Holy shit! Toland set the aerosol can on the night table, one hand still covered in shaving cream.
"Can you tell us if any of them were among the dead or wounded?" Diana asked at once.
"No, Diana. You see, we're more than a quarter of a mile away, and the senior Kremlin officials arrive by car. When they do, that is, they come in from the other side of the fortress, through another gate. So we never even knew that they were here. But the militia captain with our team did, and he kind of blurted it out. His exact words were, 'My God, the Politburo's in there.'
Rich, can you tell us what the reaction in Moscow has been like?"
"It's still pretty hard for us to gauge, Diana, since we've been right here covering the story as it unfolds. The Kremlin guards' reaction is just what you might imagine. Just like American Secret Service people would react, I suppose. A mixture of horror and rage. But I want to make it clear that that rage is not being directed against anyone. Certainly not against Americans. I told the militia officer who's been with us that I was in the U.S. Capitol building when the Weatherman's bomb was set off back in 1970, and he replied rather disgustedly that communism was indeed catching up with capitalism, that the Soviet Union was growing a bumper crop of hooligans. It's a measure of how seriously they're taking this that a Soviet police officer would comment so openly on a subject that they're not all that willing to discuss normally. So if I had to pick one word to describe the reaction here, that word would be shock. So, to summarize what we know to this point, there has been a bombing incident within the Kremlin walls, possibly an attempt to eliminate the Soviet Politburo, though I must emphasize we are not certain of that. We have had it confirmed by police at the scene that at least 3 people are dead, with 40 or so other wounded, those wounded being evacuated to nearby hospitals. We will be reporting throughout the day as more information becomes available. This is Rich Sudler, CNN, coming to you live from the Kremlin."
The scene shifted back to the anchor desk.
And there you have it. Another exclusive report from Cable Network News. Diana, the anchor person, smiled, and the screen faded again, this time to a commercial for a light beer from Miller. Marty stood up and put on a robe.
"I'll get the coffee going."
"Holy shit," Toland said again. He took longer than usual to shave, nicking himself twice as he kept looking in the mirror at his own eyes rather than his jawline. He dressed quickly, then looked in on his sleeping children. He decided against waking them. 40 minutes later, he was in his car heading south, down U.S. 301, with his windows open, allowing cool night air to wash over him, and the car radio tuned to an all-news station.
It was clear enough what was happening in the U.S. military. A bomb had been set off, probably a bomb in the Kremlin. Toland reminded himself that reporters hard up against deadlines, or TV types trying to score an instant scoop, often did not have the time to check things out. Maybe it was a gas main. Did Moscow have gas mains? If it were a bomb, he was sure the Soviets would instinctively think that the West had something to do with it, regardless of what that Sudler fellow thought, and go to higher alert status. The West would automatically do the same, in anticipation of possible Soviet action. Nothing too obvious, nothing to provoke them further, mainly an exercise conducted by intelligence and surveillance types. The Soviets would understand that. That's how the game was played. More from their side than from ours, Toland reflected, remembering assassination attempts against American presidents. What if they really do think? Toland wondered. No, he decided. They had to know that no one was that crazy. Didn't they? Norfolk, Virginia. He drove for another 3 hours, wishing that he'd drunk more coffee and less wine, and listening to his car radio to stay awake. He arrived just after 7, the normal beginning of the day's work. He was surprised to find Colonel Lowe at his desk. "I don't report to Lejeune until Tuesday, so I decided to come in and take a look at this. How was the drive?" "I made it alive. That's about all I can say. What's happening?" "You'll love it." Lowe held up a telex sheet. "We pirated this off the Reuters wire half an hour ago, and CIA confirms, meaning they probably stole it too, that the KGB has arrested one Gerhard Falken, a West German national, and accused him of setting off a bomb in the fucking Kremlin." The Marine let out a long breath. "He missed the big shots, but now they're saying that among the victims are 6 young Oktoberists, from Pskov, by God, who were making a presentation to the Politburo. Kids. There's going to be hell to pay." Toland shook his head. It couldn't get much worse than that. "And they say a German did it?" "A West German," Lowe corrected. "NATO intel services are already going ape trying to run him down. The official Soviet statement gives his name and address, some suburb of Bremen, and business, a small import-export house. Nothing else yet on that subject, but the Russian Foreign Ministry did go on to say that they expect this despicable act of international terrorism to have no effect on the Vienna arms talks. But while they do not believe at this time that Falken was acting on his own, they have no wish to believe that we had anything to do with it." "Cute. It's going to be a shame to lose you back to your regiment, Chuck. You have such a nice way of finding the important quotes." "Commander, we just might need that regiment soon. This whole thing smells like dead fish to me. Last night, the final film in the Eisenstein Film Festival, Alexander Nevsky. A new digitalized print, a new soundtrack. And what's the message? Arise, ye Russian people, the Germans are coming. This morning we have 6 dead Russian kids, from Pskov, and a German is supposed to have planted the bomb. The only thing that doesn't fit is that it ain't exactly subtle."
"Maybe," Toland said speculatively.
He spoke like a half-hearted devil's advocate. "You think we could sell this combination of factors to the papers or anybody in Washington? It's too crazy, too coincidental. What if it is subtle or backward subtle? Besides, the object of the exercise wouldn't be to convince us, it would be to convince their own citizens. You could say it works both ways. That makes sense, Chuck?" Lowe nodded. "Enough to check out. Let's do some sniffing around. First thing, I want you to call CNN in Atlanta and find out how long this Sudler guy has been trying to tape his story about the Kremlin. How much lead time did he have? When was this approved? Who he worked through to get it? And if someone other than his regular press contact finally did approve it?"
"Set up." Toland said it out loud.
He wondered if they were being clever, or clinically paranoid. He knew what most people would think.
You can't smuggle a penthouse into Russia without using the diplomatic bag. And now we're supposed to believe a German smuggled a bomb in? Then tries to blow up the Politburo?
Could we do it? Toland wondered aloud.
If CIA was crazy enough to try it, God, that's more than just crazy.
Lowe shook his head.
I don't think anybody could do it, even the Russians themselves. It's got to be a layered defense. X-ray machines, sniffer dogs, a couple of hundred guards, all from three different commands, the Army, KGB, MVD, probably their militia, too. Hell, Bob, you know how paranoid they are against their own people. How do you suppose they feel about Germans?
So they can't say he was a crazy operating on his own.
Which leaves?
Yeah. Toland reached for his phone to call CNN. Kiev, the Ukraine.
Children, Alexeyev barely said aloud. For our Maskirovka, the party murders children. Our own children. What have we come to?
What have I come to? If I can rationalize the judicial murder of four colonels and some privates, why shouldn't the Politburo blow up a few children? Alexeyev told himself there was a difference. His general was also pale as he switched off the television set.
Arise, ye Russian people. We must set these thoughts aside, Pasha. It is hard, but we must. The state is not perfect, but it is the state we must serve.
Alexeyev eyed his commander closely. The general had almost choked on those words. He was already practicing how to use them on the crucial few who would know of this outrage, yet had to perform their duties as though it never existed. There will come a day of reckoning, Pasha told himself, a day of reckoning for all the crimes committed in the name of socialist progress. He wondered if he'd live to see it, and decided he probably wouldn't.
Moscow, RSFSR.
The revolution has come to this, he thought.
Sergeyev was staring into the rubble. The sun was still high, even this late in the afternoon. The firefighters and soldiers were almost finished sorting through the wreckage, heaving the loose pieces into trucks a few meters from where he stood. There was dust on his suit. I'll have to have it cleaned, he thought, watching the seventh small body being lifted with a gentleness all too late and obscenely out of place. One more child was still unaccounted for, and there was still some lingering hope. A uniformed army medic stood nearby, unwrapped dressings in his quivering hands. To his left, a major of infantry was weeping with rage. A man with a family, no doubt. The television cameras were there, of course. A lesson learned from the American media, Sergeyev thought. The crews poking their way into the action to record every horrible scene for the evening news. He was surprised to see an American crew with their Soviet counterparts. So we have made mass murder an international spectator sport. Sergeyev was far too angry for visible emotion. That could have been me, he thought. I always show up early for the Thursday meetings. Everyone knows it. The guards, the clerical staff, and certainly my comrades on the Politburo. So this is the penultimate segment of the Maskirovka. To motivate, to lead our people, we must do this. Was there supposed to be a Politburo member in the rubble, he wondered. A junior member, of course.
Surely I am wrong, Sergeyev told himself.
One part of his mind examined the question with chilling objectivity, while another considered his personal friendships with some of the senior Politburo members. He didn't know what to think. An odd position for a leader of the party. Norfolk, Virginia.
I am Gerhard Falken, the man said. I entered the Soviet Union 6 days ago through the port of Odessa. I have been for 10 years an agent of the Bundesnachrichtendienst, the intelligence apparat of the government of West Germany.
My assignment was to kill the Politburo at its Thursday morning session by means of a bomb placed in a storage room directly beneath the fourth-floor conference room in which they meet.
Lowe and Toland watched their televisions in total fascination. It was perfect. Falcon spoke perfect Russian, with the precise syntax and diction that schoolteachers in the Soviet Union sought to achieve. His accent was that of Leningrad.
I have run an import-export business in Bremen for many years, and I have specialized in trade with the Soviet Union. I have traveled into the Soviet Union many times, and on many of these occasions I have used my business identity to run agents whose mission was to weaken and spy upon the Soviet party and military infrastructures.
The camera closed in.
Falcon was reading in a monotone from a script, his eyes seldom rising to the cameras. Behind the glasses on one side was a large bruise. His hands shook slightly when he changed pages of the script.
"Looks like they beat up on him some," Lowe observed.
"Interesting," Toland replied. "They're letting us know that they work people over."
Lowe snorted.
"A guy who blows little kids up? You can burn the bastard at the stake, and who'll give a good goddamn? Some serious thought went into this, my friend."
"I wish to make it clear," Falcon went on in a firmer voice, "that I had no intention of injuring children. The Politburo was a legitimate political target, but my country does not make war on children."
A howl of disgust came from off-camera. As though on cue, the camera backed away to reveal a pair of uniformed KGB officers flanking the speaker, their faces impassive. The audience was composed of about 20 people in civilian clothes.
"Why did you come into our country?" demanded one of them.
"I have told you this."
"Why does your country wish to kill the leaders of our Soviet party?"
"I am a spy," Falcon replied. "I carry out assignments. I do not ask such questions. I follow my orders."
"How were you captured?"
"I was arrested at the Kiev railroad station. How I was caught, they have not told me."
"Cute," Lowe commented.
"He called himself a spy," Toland objected.
"You don't say that. You call yourself an officer. An agent is a foreigner who works for you, and a spy is a bad guy. They use the same terms that we do."
The CIA-DIA report arrived on the telex printer an hour later. Gerhard Eugen Falcon, age 44, born in Bonn. Educated in public schools, good marks on his records. But his picture was missing from his high school yearbook. Military service as a draftee in a transport battalion whose records had been destroyed in a barracks fire 12 years before. Honorable discharge found in his personal effects. University degree in liberal arts, good marks, but again no picture. And three professors who gave him B grades can't seem to recall him. A small import-export business. Where did the money come from to start it? Nobody could answer that one. Lived in Bremen quietly, modestly, and alone. Friendly man, after a fashion. Always nodded to his neighbors, but never socialized with them. A good, very correct, his elderly secretary said, boss to his employees. Traveled a lot. In short, many people knew he existed. Quite a few did business with his firm. But nobody really knew a thing about him. I can hear the papers now. This guy has agency written all over him. Toland tore off the printer paper and tucked it into a folder. He had to brief Sinklant in half an hour.
And tell him what? Toland wondered.
Tell him the Germans are going to attack Russia. Who knows, maybe this time they'll take Moscow, Lowe mused.
God damn it, Chuck.
Okay, maybe just an operation to cripple the Russians so that they can reunite Germany once and for all. That's what Ivan is saying, Bob.
Lowe looked out the window.
What we have here is a classic intelligence op. This guy Falcon is a stone spook.
No way in hell we can tell who he is, where he comes from, or, of course, who he's working for. Unless something big breaks. And I'll wager you that it doesn't. We know, we think, that the Germans aren't this crazy. But the only evidence there is points to them. Tell the Admiral something bad is happening.
Toland did precisely that, only to have his head nearly taken off by a senior man who wanted and needed hard information.
Kiev, the Ukraine.
Comrades, we will commence offensive operations against the NATO land forces in 2 weeks, Alexeyev began.
He explained the reasons for this.
The assembled corps and division commanders accepted the information impassively. The danger to the state is as great as anything we've had to face in over 40 years. We have used the past 4 months to whip our army into shape. You and your subordinates have responded well to our demands. And I can only say that I am proud to have served with you. I will leave the usual party harangue to your group political officers.
Alexeyev ventured a single smile in his delivery.
We are the professional officers of the Soviet Army. We know what our task is. We know why we have it. The life of the Rodina depends on our ability to carry out our mission. Nothing else matters, he concluded.
The hell it doesn't.
Chapter 11. Order of Battle. Shpola, the Ukraine.
You may proceed, Comrade Colonel, Alexeyev said over his radio circuit.
He didn't say, make a fool of me now, and you will be counting trees.
The general stood on a hill 500 meters west of the regimental command post.
With him was his aide, and Politburo member Mikhail Sergeyev.
As if I need that distraction, the general thought bleakly.
First the guns. They saw the flashes long before they heard the rolling thunder of the reports. Fired from behind another hill 3 kilometers away, the shells arced through the sky to their left, cutting through the air with a sound like the ripping of linen.
The party man cringed at the noise, Alexeyev noted. Another soft civilian.
I never did like that sound, Sergeyev said shortly.
Heard it before, Comrade Minister? The general asked, solicitously.
I served my 4 years in a motor rifle regiment, he replied. And I never learned to trust my comrades at the artillery plotting tables. Foolish, I know. Excuse me, General.
Next came the tank guns. They watched through binoculars as the big main battle tanks emerged from the woods like something from a nightmare, their long cannon belching flame as they glided across the rolling ground of the exercise area. Interspersed with the tanks were the infantry fighting vehicles. Then came the armed helicopters, swooping at the objective from left and right, firing their guided missiles at the mock-ups of bunkers and armored vehicles. By this time the hilltop objective was nearly hidden by explosions and flying dirt as the artillery fire marched back and forth across it. Alexeyev's trained eye evaluated the exercise closely. Anyone on that hilltop would be having a very hard time. Even in a small, deep, protective hole, even in a defilated tank, that artillery fire would be terrifying, enough to distract the guided weapons crews, enough to rattle communications men, perhaps enough to impede the officers there.
Perhaps.
But what of return fire from enemy artillery? What of anti-tank helicopters and aircraft that could sweep over the advancing tank battalions?
So many unknowns in battle. So many imponderables.
So many reasons to gamble, and so many reasons not to. What if there were Germans on that hill? Did the Germans get rattled? Even in 1945 at the gates of Berlin, had Germans ever been rattled?
It took 12 minutes before the tanks and infantry carriers were atop the hill. The exercise was over.
Nicely done, Comrade General.
Sergeyev removed his ear protectors.
It was good to be away from Moscow, he thought, even for a few hours. Why, he wondered, did he feel more at home here than in his chosen place? Was it this man?
As I recall, the standard for this particular drill is 14 minutes. The tanks and infantry vehicles cooperated well. I've never seen the use of armed helicopters, but that, too, was impressive.
The greatest improvement was the coordination of artillery fire and infantry in the final assault phase. Before, they failed miserably. This time it was done properly. A tricky procedure.
Well, I know it, Sergeyev laughed. My company never took casualties from this, but two of my friends did. Fortunately, none of them fatal.
Excuse my saying so, Comrade Minister, but it is good to see that our Politburo members have also served the state in a uniformed capacity. It makes communication easier for us poor soldiers.
Alexeyev knew that it never hurt to have a friend at court, and Sergeyev seemed a decent chap.
My older son just left military service last year. My younger son will also serve the Red Army when he leaves the university.
It was not often that the general was so surprised. Alexeyev lowered his binoculars to stare briefly at the party man.
"You need not say it, Comrade General," Sergeyev smiled. "I know that too few children of high party officials do this. I have spoken against it. Those who would rule must first serve. So I have some questions for you."
"Follow me, Comrade Minister. We shall speak sitting down." The two men walked back to Alexeyev's armored command vehicle. The general's aide dismissed the vehicle's crew and himself, leaving the two senior men alone inside the converted infantry carrier. The general pulled a thermos of hot tea from a compartment and poured two metal cups of the steaming liquid.
"Your health, Comrade Minister."
"And yours, Comrade General." Sergeyev sipped briefly, then set the cup down on the map table.
"How ready are we for Red Storm?"
"The improvement since January is remarkable. Our men are fit. They have been drilling in their tasks continuously. I would honestly prefer another 2 months, but yes, I think we are ready."
"Well said, Pavel Leonidovich. Now, shall we speak the truth?"
The Politburo member said this with a smile, but Alexeyev was instantly on guard.
"I am not a fool, Comrade Minister. Lying to you would be madness."
"In our country, truth is often greater madness.
Let us speak frankly. I am a candidate member of the Politburo. I have power, yes, but you and I both know what the limits of that power are. Only candidate members are out with our forces now, and we are tasked with reporting back to the full members. You might also draw some meaning from the fact that I am here with you, not in Germany."
That was not entirely true, Alexeyev noted. This unit would entrain for Germany in 3 days, and that was why the party man was here.
"Are we truly ready, Comrade General? Will we win?
If we have strategic surprise, and if the Maskarovka succeeds, yes. I believe we should win," Alexeyev said cautiously.
"Not we will surely win?"
"You have served in uniform, Comrade Minister. On the field of battle, there are no certainties. The measure of an army is not known until it has been blooded. Ours has not. We have done everything we know how to do to make our army ready."
"You said you wished for 2 more months, Sergeyev noted.
"A task like this is never truly finished. There are always improvements that need to be made. Only a month ago we initiated a program of replacing some senior officers at battalion and regimental level with younger, more vigorous subordinates. It is working very well indeed, but a number of these young captains, now in major's jobs, could do with some further seasoning."
"So you still have doubts?"
"There are always doubts, Comrade Minister. Fighting a war is not an exercise in mathematics. We deal with people, not numbers. Numbers have their own special kind of perfection."
People remain people, no matter what we try to do with them.
That is good, Pavel Leonidovich. That is very good.
I have found an honest man. Sergeyev toasted the general with his tea.
I asked to come here. A comrade on the Politburo, Pyotr Bromkovsky, told me of your father.
Uncle Petya, Alexeyev nodded.
He was commissar with my father's division on the drive to Vienna.
He often visited our home when I was young.
He is well?
No, he is old and sick. He says that the attack on the West is madness. The ramblings of an old man, perhaps, but his war record is distinguished. And because of that, I want your evaluation of our chances.
I will not inform on you, General. Too many people are fearful of telling us, we of the Politburo, the truth.
But this is a time for that truth. I need your professional opinion.
If I can trust you to give it to me, you can trust me not to harm you for it.
The entreaty ended as a harsh command.
Alexeyev looked his guest hard in the eyes. The charm was gone now. The blue was the color of ice. There was danger here, danger even for a general officer. But what the man had said was true.
Comrade, we plan on a rapid campaign. The projections are that we can reach the Rhine in 2 weeks. Those are actually more conservative than our plans of only 5 years ago. NATO has improved its readiness, particularly its anti-tank capabilities. I would say 3 weeks is more realistic, depending on the degree of tactical surprise and the many imponderables present in war.
So the key is surprise?
The key is always surprise, Alexeyev answered at once.
He quoted Soviet doctrine exactly. Surprise is the greatest factor in war. There are two kinds, tactical and strategic. Tactical surprise is an operational art. A skilled unit commander can generally achieve it. Strategic surprise is attained on the political level.
That is your mission, not mine. And it is far more important than anything we in the army can do.
With true strategic surprise, if our Maskirovka works, yes, we will almost certainly win on the battlefield.
And if not?
Then we have murdered 8 children for nothing, Alexeyev thought. And what part did this charming fellow have in that?
Then we might fail.
Can you answer me a question? Can we split NATO politically?
Sergeyev shrugged, annoyed at being caught in one of his own traps.
As you said, Pavel Leonidovich, there are many imponderables. If it fails, then what?
Then the war will become a test of will and a test of reserves.
We should win. It is far easier for us to reinforce our troops. We have more trained troops, more tanks, more aircraft close to the zone of action than do the NATO powers.
And America?
America is on the far side of the Atlantic Ocean. We have a plan for closing the Atlantic. They can fly troops to Europe, but only troops, not their weapons, not their fuel. Those require ships, and ships are easier to sink than it is to destroy a fighting division. If full surprise is not achieved, that operational area will become quite important.
And what of NATO surprises?
The general leaned back. By definition, you cannot predict surprises, comrade. That is why we have the intelligence organs, to reduce or even eliminate them. That is why our plans allow for a number of contingencies. For example, what if surprise is totally lost and NATO attacks first?
He shrugged.
They would not go far, but they would upset things. What still concerns me are nuclear responses. Again, more of a political question.
Yes.
Sergeyev's worry was for his elder son. When the reserves were mobilized, Ivan would climb back into his tank, and he didn't need to be a Politburo member to know where that tank would be sent. Alexeyev had only daughters.
Lucky man, Sergeyev thought.
So this unit goes to Germany?
The end of the week.
And you?
During the initial phase, we are tasked to be the strategic reserve for SyncWest's operations, plus to defend the motherland against possible incursions from the southern flank.
That does not concern us greatly.
To threaten us, Greece and Turkey must cooperate. They will not unless our intelligence information is completely false. My commander and I will later execute phase two of the plan and seize the Persian Gulf. Again, this will not be a problem. The Arabs are armed to the teeth, but there are not so many of them.
What is your son doing now?
The elder?
He's ending his first year of graduate school in languages.
Top of his class. Middle Eastern languages.
Sergeyev was surprised at himself for not thinking of this.
I could use a few more of those. Most of our Arabic language people are Muslims themselves, and for this task I would prefer people more reliable.
And you do not trust the followers of Allah?
In war, I trust no one. If your son is good at these languages, I will find a use for him, be sure of that.
The formal agreement was made with nods, and each wondered if the other had planned it that way.
Norfolk, Virginia.
Progress hasn't ended as scheduled, Toland said. Satellite and other reconnaissance shows that the Soviet forces in Germany and western Poland are still together in operational formations living in the field. There are indications that rail transport is being marshaled at various points in the Soviet Union. That is, at points consistent with plans to move large numbers of troops west. Soviet Northern Fleet this morning sortied 6 submarines. The move is ostensibly a scheduled rotation to replace their operational squadron in the Med. So, for the next 2 weeks, they'll have more subs in the North Atlantic than is normally the case.
Tell me about the group rotating out of the Med, Sinclant ordered.
A Victor, an Echo, 3 Foxtrots, and a Juliet. They all spent the last week tied alongside their tender at Tripoli. The tender stayed put in Libyan territorial waters. They will clear the Straits of Gibraltar around 1300 Zulu tomorrow.
They're not waiting for the new group to relieve them on station first?
No, Admiral. Usually they do wait for the replacement group to enter the Med. But about a third of the time they do it this way. That gives us 12 Soviet subs in transit north and south, plus a November and 3 more Foxtrots that have been exercising with the Cuban Navy. At the moment, they are all tied alongside also. We checked up on them this morning. That data is 2 hours old.
Okay, what about Europe?
No further information on Mr. Falcon. The NATO intelligence services have run up against a blank wall, and there's been nothing new from Moscow, not even a date for the public trial. The Germans say that they have no knowledge whatever of the guy. It's just as though he appeared fully grown at age 31 when he started his business. His apartment was taken apart one stick at a time. No incriminating evidence was found.
Okay, Commander. Give us your professional gut feeling.
Admiral Falcon is a Soviet sleeper agent who was inserted into the Federal Republic 13 years ago and used for very few missions, or, more probably, none at all, until this.
So you think this whole thing's a Soviet intelligence operation?
No big surprise there.
What's its objective? Sinclant asked sharply.
Sir, at the very least, they are trying to put enormous political pressure on West Germany. Perhaps to force them out of NATO. At worst,
I think we already figured the worst-case scenario out.
Nice job, Toland.
And I owe you an apology for yesterday.
Not your fault that you didn't have all the information I wanted.
Toland blinked.
It was not that often that a 4-star admiral apologized to a reserve lieutenant commander in front of other flag officers.
What's their fleet doing?
Admiral, we have no satellite photos of the Murmansk area. Too much cloud cover. But we expect clear weather tomorrow afternoon. The Norwegians are running increased air patrols in the Barents Sea,
and they say that, aside from submarines, the Russians have relatively few ships at sea at the moment. Of course, they've had relatively few ships at sea for a month.
And that can change in 3 hours, an admiral noted. Your evaluation of their fleet readiness?
The best it's been since I've been studying them, Toland replied. As close to 100% as I've ever seen it.
As you just said, sir, they can put to sea at any time with almost their whole inventory.
If they sortie, we'll know it quick. I have 3 subs up there keeping an eye on things, Admiral Pipes said.
I talked with the Secretary of Defense right before I came here. He's going to meet with the President today and request a DEFCON 3 alert, global. The Germans are requesting that we keep Spiral Green in operation until the Russians show signs of easing things off.
What do you think the Russians will do, Commander? Sinclair asked.
Sir, we'll know more later today. The Soviet Party Secretary will be speaking at an emergency meeting of the Supreme Soviet, maybe also at the funeral tomorrow.
Sentimental bastard, Pipes growled. In front of the office television, an hour later, Toland missed having Chuck Lowe around to back up his translation. The chairman had an annoying tendency to speak rapidly, and Toland's Russian was barely up to it. The speech took 40 minutes, 3/4 of which was standard political phraseology. At the end, however, the chairman announced mobilization of Category B reserve units to meet the potential German threat. Chapter 12. Funeral Arrangements. Norfolk, Virginia. The House of Unions was unusually crowded, Toland saw. Ordinarily, they only buried one hero at a time with such ceremony. Once there had been 3 dead cosmonauts, but now there were 11 heroes. 8 young Octobrists from Pskov, 3 boys and 5 girls ranging in age from 8 to 10, and 3 clerical employees, all men who worked directly for the Politburo, were laid out in polished birchwood coffins, surrounded by a sea of flowers. Toland examined the screen closely. The caskets were elevated so that the victims were visible, but 2 of the faces were covered with black silk, a framed photograph atop the coffins to show what the children had looked like in life. It was a piteous, horrible touch for the television cameras to linger on. The Hall of Columns was draped in red and black, with even the ornate chandeliers masked for this solemn occasion. The families of the victims stood in an even line. Parents without their children, wives and children without fathers. They were dressed in the baggy, ill-cut clothes so characteristic of the Soviet Union. Their faces showed no emotion but shock, as if they were still trying to come to terms with the damage done to their lives, still hoping that they'd awake from this ghastly nightmare to find their loved ones safe in their own beds, and knowing that this would not be. The chairman of the party came somberly down the line, embracing each of the bereaved, a black mourning band on his sleeve to contrast with the gaudy Order of Lenin emblem on his lapel. Toland looked closely at his face. There was real emotion there. One could almost imagine that he was burying members of his own family. One of the mothers accepted the embrace, then the kiss, and nearly collapsed, falling to her knees and burying her face in her hands. The chairman dropped down to her side even before her husband did, and pulled her head into his shoulder. A moment later, he helped her back to her feet, moving her gently toward the protective arm of her husband, a captain in the Soviet Army whose face was a stone mask of rage. God Almighty, Toland thought. They couldn't have staged that any better with Eisenstein himself directing. Moscow, RSFSR.
You cold-hearted bastard, Sergeyev said to himself.
He and the rest of the Politburo stood in another line to the left of the caskets. He kept his face pointed forward, toward the line of coffins, but he averted his eyes, only to see 4 television cameras recording the ceremony.
The whole world was watching them, the TV people had assured them. So exquisitely organized it was. Here was the penultimate act of the Maskirovka. The honor guard of Red Army soldiers mixed with boys and girls of the Moscow Young Pioneers to watch over the murdered children. The lilting violins. Such a masquerade, Sergeyev told himself. See how kind we are to the families of those we have murdered. He had seen many lies in his 35 years in the party. He had told enough of them himself. But never anything that came close to this. Just as well, he thought, that I've had nothing to eat today. His eyes came back, reluctantly, to the waxen face of a child. He remembered the sleeping faces of his own children, now grown. So often after arriving home late from party work, he had stolen a look into their bedroom at night to see their peaceful faces, always lingering to be sure that they were breathing normally, listening for the sniffles of a cold or the murmurs of a dream. How often had he told himself that he and the party worked for their future? No more colds, little one, he said with his eyes to the nearest child. No more dreams. See what the party has done for your future. His own eyes filled with tears, and he hated himself for it. His comrades would think it part of the performance. He wanted to look around, to see what his comrades of the Politburo thought of their handiwork. He wondered what the KGB team that had done the deed thought of their mission now. If they were still alive, he reflected. So easy to put them on an airplane and crash it into the ground so that not even executioners would know of them. All records of the bomb plot were already destroyed, he was sure. And of the 30 men who knew of it, more than half were right there, standing in line with him. Sergeyev almost wished he had entered the building 5 minutes sooner. Better to be dead than to be a beneficiary of such infamy. But he knew better. In that case, he would have played an even larger role in this brutal farce. Norfolk, Virginia. Comrades, we see before us the innocent children of our nation, the chairman began, speaking with slow, quiet diction that made Toland's translation job easier. Sinclair's intelligence chief was at his side. Killed by the infernal engine of state terrorism. Killed by a nation that has twice defiled our motherland with unholy dreams of conquest and murder. We see before us the dedicated, humble servants of our party, who asked nothing more than to serve the state. We see martyrs to the security of the Soviet Union. We see martyrs to the aggression of fascists. Comrades, to the families of these innocent children, and to the families of these 3 fine men, I say that a reckoning will come. I say that their deaths will not be forgotten. I say that there will be justice for this vicious crime.
Jesus. Toland stopped translating and looked over at his senior.
Yeah, there's going to be a war. We have a linguistic team across the street doing a full translation, Bob. Let's go see the boss.
You're sure? Sinclair asked.
It's possible they will settle for something less, sir, Toland replied. But I don't think so. Everything about this exercise has been run in such a way as to inflame the Russian population to a degree I've never seen before.
Let's put this all the way on the table. You're saying that they deliberately murdered these people to foment a crisis.
Sinclair looked down at his desk.
It's hard to believe, even for them.
Admiral, either we believe that, or we believe that the West German government has decided to precipitate a war against the Soviet Union on their own hook. In the second case, the Germans would have to be totally out of their fucking mind, sir, Toland blurted, forgetting that only admirals swear in front of admirals.
But why?
We don't know the why. That's a problem with intelligence, sir.
It's a lot easier to tell the what than the why.
Sinclair stood and walked to the corner of his office. There was going to be a war, and he didn't know why. He wanted the why. The why might be important.